Remember, up to this day, the British had had a colonial empire which faced troops that were armed simply with hand-to-hand weapons or bows and arrows. Nothing greater than that. So their strategy, their tactics, their uniforms, their whole supply chains and so on were designed around this ability to bring firepower to bear on basically native troops. This is how they were dressed. You can imagine this was meat and drink to a Boer with a mortar. Mortars could knock over these guys with their beautiful target uniforms at 500 meters. Remember, the Boers had from childhood been used to self-sufficiency. They could knock over an eland or a wildebeest or whatever at 500 meters. These guys were meat and drink. In addition, because the British had faced those types of native troops before, they fought in close formations. The square, which you know was famous in Napoleonic times, had grafted itself over to here, and it was still the method of fighting by the British troops. People in this audience will know that most of the drill that we now do comes from this era. It was designed to efficiently form line, form square, form column, and so on, and you'll see it on drill squares all over the British world. So they were still at that stage. But after a couple of battles, particularly against Maxim guns and mortars fired by skilled marksmen, this was not the way to dress in South Africa. So they redesigned it to look like this. Towards the end of the Boer War, this was the uniform now used in South Africa. You can see it's much more efficient, and for the first time we see this wonderful thing called khaki coming into play. I want to talk just about one battle in this talk, and I want to pick Spion Kop, because Spion Kop shows a number of lessons between these two opposing and contradicting types of warfare. So the British tactics were developed in these lands like Western Frontier, Zululand, Sudan, and other colonial wars. Shoulder-to-shoulder formations. Disaster, as we've seen, against modern weapons. But the New Zealand troops, this is where we start to see the uniqueness of New Zealand thinking. Not only in this war, in future wars as well. New Zealand troops did not actually use their horses. They were called mounted infantry, but remember, that's not cavalry. Mounted infantry use a form of motion, locomotion, like horses, or now armoured personnel carriers, the light armoured vehicles that are currently in our army and so on, simply to get to an objective to where they can dismount, and then they could use their favourite tactics of fire and movement in order to close with the enemy. So New Zealanders, for the first time, show this method of fighting. Let's have a look at Spion Kop. This is, of course, a modern photograph of Spion Kop. The road didn't exist. But this is Spion itself. This is a false Spion. On the back of this is a plateau. So what we find is that the British come across this. Spion Kop is not far from Ladysmith. And Ladysmith had been invested by the Boers in an attempt to force the British to come to the bargaining table. They wanted to starve out Ladysmith and Kimberley, by the way, at the same time. But Ladysmith is just on the other side of Spion Kop. The Boers here decided that they would make a stand. Up to now, they'd been hit and run all over Transvaal and Orange Free State. They decided to make a stand on Spion Kop, mainly because without Spion Kop, they could not prevent the relief of Ladysmith. So here's a planned drawing of Spion Kop. Ladysmith is up in this corner here, and you have two lines of hills. This is the false, and this is the main Spion Kop. Between them is a slightly, you saw that, the saddle. The British decided, they'd had a number of bloody noses by this time, and they decided that they would not take on the Boers head on in daylight. So they planned for a silent night attack. So as you can see here, the infantry, these solid lines here, and the cavalry. At this stage, remember that the British still had cavalry. They still intended to have cavalry charges against machine guns and weapons like the Mauser. Don't worry about it. When they first started World War I, they still had cavalry. And they still planned to have cavalry charges. However, this is what it looked like. So you can see that you've got a main attack, silent at night, reserves, artillery, cavalry. The idea was that they would go up onto this line here. This is a plateau area. They would come onto this in darkness, and at about 4 o'clock in the morning, they would charge the final area, and they would then establish themselves at night, ready for daylight, so that they could look over the top of Spion Kop and use it for artillery to attack the retreating Boers going into Ladysmith. That was the plan. Unfortunately, a number of things happened. The first thing that happened was that they mistook this feature for this feature at night. So they all ended up on this feature. When the fog started to lift at dawn, they realized they were on the wrong feature, so they then turned and attacked this feature. The Boers, seeing that they were outnumbered, faded away as usual. They landed up on this flat area, it was complete solid rock. Below this, about this level, solid rock. They started to dig in, they got that far, couldn't go any further, and the Boers had now come back onto this position here. At 300 meters, it was like a duck shoot. The British could not get further than that below the surface. The Boers at 300 meters with their Mausers and their machine guns could fire straight down that particular ridgeline or flat area. The carnage was amazing. All day it went on. Something like 1,300 British were killed for something like 60 Boers. The Boers, at darkness, the British said, "We've got to get out of here." So they withdrew back to where they had started. The Boers, having achieved what they wanted to achieve, faded away. It was a disaster for British arms. One of the things I wanted to show you was this. This is a sketch drawing of the cavalry here waiting to charge up that slope that you saw at Spion Kop. It would be difficult enough for a fit man to walk up there, let alone cavalry to charge. But you can see the mindset had not moved from this imperial model here to the model of asymmetric warfare that we now know. This, of course, is disaster. Against Maxim guns and mortars, this is disaster. Okay, let's have a look at this Mauser. This was the very modern weapon of its day. Magazine fed, 5 rounds in a magazine. Magazine here. This weapon, about 3.7 kilograms, quite a weighty weapon, but accurate up to 500 meters. So the real interesting thing to me is, if you're into weapons at all, the muzzle velocity of this weapon was amazing. It also fired smokeless cartridges. For the very first time in warfare, the cartridges were totally smokeless. So the Boers could hide themselves on Spion Kop, for example, behind a rock, and the British could not find them. No smoke in the weapon at all. Unfortunately, coming to us from there, we find a little bit of a problem with the Boers' use of this weapon. This is the Mauser solid shot. Next door to it is a soft-nosed bullet. Now banned, of course, by the Geneva Convention, but used extensively by the Boers and created considerably greater wounds and exit wounds in particular than a solid shot. At 500 meters, it was almost certain death. However, that's what it was at the time. Having gone through things like Spion Kop and so on, and remember also that before this war, the British had gone through the Zulu Wars and got a very bloody nose from those wars. After Spion Kop, there was a change of commander, and General Lord Kitchener was now put in command of the troops in South Africa. Kitchener took a totally different view. This was no longer a gentleman's war. Up to this time, it was considered a gentleman's war. Now, it was considered that the gloves were off. So Kitchener arrives in 1900, and he orders a scorched earth policy. This was a terrible business. All farms in both Transvaal and Orange Free State were to be destroyed. Buildings were to be burnt to the ground, crops were to be destroyed, and all animals were to be slaughtered. This, of course, was designed as a military commander. You can see why this might happen. This was designed to cut off the Boers from their supply chain. Their only supply chain was their own farms. So this was designed for that specific reason. Whoops, I've gone back again. So the result of this scorched earth policy were terrible. New Zealanders were involved in this, by the way. 90% of all war farms were destroyed. 40 towns were totally or partially destroyed. Over 3.6 million sheep. That doesn't sound a lot to a country like us, but that 3.6 million sheep was practically all the sheep. And for the first time, concentration camps appear in our word process. Here, in fact, is a photograph of members of New Zealand's 6th contingent burning a Boer farm. Note also the slaughtered sheep. And then we come to this vexed question of concentration camps. As a direct result of that scorched earth policy, all non-combatant Boers were placed in concentration camps. All, men, women, children. Over 130,000 Boer women and children, as well as older men, were interned in over 55 camps in the Cape. You can imagine that with the paucity of medical care and so on, the suffering and disease was rampant throughout those camps. An estimated 27,000 Boers, men, women and children, died from starvation and disease epidemics. When you look at this from a military point of view, only 12% of all Boer fatalities died in actual battle. But 65% of the casualties died in concentration camps. This is the legacy that we now face in South Africa. There were 65 separate camps for all Africans who were Boer laborers or tenant farmers. In fact, a lot of Africans actually fought on behalf of the Boers in some of those commandos. Of these, another 14,000 Africans died in the separate concentration camps that were established for Africans. Captured Boer officers was interesting. They ended up at St. Helena, which was, of course, where Napoleon ended up. And then a number of them were also sent to Sri Lanka, or what was then Ceylon. Most of these died in those areas. They did not return to South Africa. So the Boer peoples of the two republics were in fact deprived of their top leadership when they went into the peace process. Emily Hobson, who was a British reformer, visited all of these camps in South Africa and campaigned seriously to Parliament in London to ease their suffering. She didn't get very far because Kitchener and his staff, of course, were intent on this particular strategy, and so she was not welcome in South Africa. But she did have some effect in London. Here is a concentration camp at Bloemfontein. You notice it's tents. We get now to the stage that with all of this scorched earth, still the British could not subdue the Boers. Kitchener decided that the only way to do that was to limit their movement, because one of their tactics, of course, was hit and run. Boers knew their country well, they understood every rock and stream in the country, and they were able to hit and fade back into the country. He needed to do something about this. He needed to limit their movements in the country, and these barbed wire enclosures were his answer. Remember I showed you this railway system that existed at the time in South Africa. Let's superimpose on that the blockhouse system that was finally developed. You'll see that basically it follows the railway system. And there was a good reason for that. Most of these blockhouses were in fact built and prefab. So these were typical blockhouses that exist today as monuments in South Africa. You'll see they are one single type of design. They were prefab in the Cape, and they were railed out along those railway systems to be erected. When you look at the size of that map that I showed you, you'll know that in order to look after one of these blockhouses, you needed about a platoon of infantry. A young subaltern officer, 30 infantry soldiers, or the equivalent, was needed to garrison each one of these. There were so many of them that it took 50,000 British to actually look after the blockhouses. That is 50 infantry battalions were sucked into this blockhouse system. And of course another 16,000 African troops. The total Boers in the field were 30,000. 50,000 plus 16,000 were taken into the blockhouses before you could put any British or Commonwealth soldiers into the field. Typical drawing of what happened, and these blockhouses used to come under serious attack from time to time. A couple of them were actually taken and blown up, but in the main, they repelled all the attempts to take them by the Boers. So, at the end of the Boer War, the losses were quite considerable, but British losses were 28,000, Boer losses were 4,000, but over 26,000 in concentration camps. The African servants, tenant farmers, and so on, 28,000. So we're going to just pause there and make a gap for me. Up to now, we've talked about the background and so on. What I want to do now is to see where did New Zealand fit into this particular system. This is a recruiting poster that I found somewhere, and the interesting thing from our point of view now is the crossed flags of Britain and New Zealand. Remember that this was a time where we had a young country here in New Zealand. We were still very much tied to the British system, and if you like, tied to its apron strings, and where Britain went, we went. Here's another little postcard which shows you this. Here's a postcard which shows Britannia, the Maori warrior, and the New Zealand flag. In fact, the haka was actually composed for this particular time of our existence. Up the side of it here, the usual invocation, and then finally, uphold the supremacy of the Queen. So, what is it then at this time that you could actually accuse New Zealand of? Was it patriotism or was it jingoism? In other words, with this sort of background, this is the contingent's colours as they were then, New Zealand flag and a British flag. Was it straight patriotism, national pride, love, devotion and sense of attachment to a country? Or was it, if you like, jingoism, which takes this a step further and is an excessive bias, looking at the superiority, extreme form of patriotism? We have to remember, of course, that this is in the turn of the century, 1904. I don't believe that this was jingoism. I believe that this was genuine patriotism on the part of New Zealand for the mother country. Remember we talked about the fact that Britain said that there was to be no Maori in any of the contingents. Any of the 10 contingents, no Maori involved. It was to be a white man's war. This, would you believe, is what the editor of the Evening Post at the turn of the century said. If the white races of the world are to employ yellow and black troops in their wars with one another, the end of European civilization would be within measurable distance. So there was a strong feeling that this was to be a white man's war. Well, let's see what happened. New Zealand Premier offers a Maori contingent right at the beginning of the first deployment of our contingents. Refused. A Maori MP offers to recruit and train 500 Maoris to fight in South Africa. This was refused by the British. So the first contingent marches down, you'd all recognize this, I think, Karori Road, Wellington, on the 21st of October, 1899. or white. We see the first sign of New Zealand Mounted Infantry. Most New Zealanders who volunteered for these contingents brought their own horses. Their horses were shipped from here to South Africa by boat. Note once again, though, that this is not cavalry. These horses are a mode of transport only. They get the soldier to his battle position and he dismounts and fights on foot. This has become pretty much a tradition in New Zealand. So much for no white man's war. This here is the Ngāpuhi Nursing Sisters of Whangarei. Note the uniforms, the empty cartridge belts, but they're beautifully, they're properly dressed, they've got all of their accoutrements there, including their water bottles and so on, and they are obviously very patriotically inclined towards what was happening here. Go a step further. This is the Greymouth Khaki Corps. Once again, a lot of Maori involved in here. Their instructor on the left-hand side. Their weaponry is all the Enfield rifles, and they are quite a formidable-looking, serious lot of people. At the other end of the scale, you have something like this. This is obviously a social gathering. Why do I think it's a social gathering? Look at their hats. None of them are placed in so-called regulation fashion. However, there is something that we should note here. These ladies and a couple of gentlemen in the background are taking this war very seriously. They're raising funds. In fact, the Governor General's daughter actually put on a display of precision riding at Government House in order to raise funds for these men across in the contingent. So they are taking it pretty seriously. Some may be looking at it from a social point of view, but in the main, there was a great deal of commitment on the part of New Zealanders to their contingents. Then, of course, you get something like this, which is quite interesting. Zealandia descends from her throne to welcome a Kiwi officer home. The mythical Zealandia, soldier, Maori warrior, and it's, from our perspective, I guess, quite an interesting sort of perspective on New Zealand life at that stage. So let's have a look at the contingents themselves. There were, as you know, 10 different contingents with some reinforcements in between. So we have a total of 315 officers and 6,100 and so soldiers who went across in those 10 contingents and the reinforcements to each one of them. When you think about this, this is quite a commitment for a country which is 750,000 strong all up. Then you take a look at this. We had 60 killed in action, some after Spion Kop. We had 11 died of wounds and 26 were accidentally killed. This figure of 16 here is actually a rail accident in Orange Free State. But then look at this, 133 died as a result of wounds. Compare that to the action in the field. Sorry, a result of disease. Okay, let's take some conclusions out of this particular war. I want to deal with some myths first. The first myth I find is the success of New Zealand's contribution to the war
encouraged the myth that required New Zealand required thousands of marksmen, but not organised military forces. This myth actually took hold and affected a lot of the plan, strategic planning for World War I. Myth number two, which we sometimes even hear now, New Zealand always punches above its weight militarily. I don't see any evidence of this. Myth number three, New Zealanders are natural soldiers who require only a modicum of training to perform effectively. How often have I heard that in the last 50 years? Okay, let's look at some facts instead of myths. Fact number one, it took 2 years and a quarter of a million men to defeat around 25,000 hardcore guerrillas. If you look at history from this point forward, you see the reality of this, that asymmetrical warfare is a long-term issue. It is not a single battle issue as we found in the Napoleonic Wars, or indeed in World War II. Asymmetrical warfare takes different resources, different commitments, and a different type of attitude to fighting of conventional war. I won't get it. The Boers in this war suffered from the same limitations as the Maori in our land wars. There was no military organisation. Each commando fought mainly alone. There was no infrastructure. And they fought with what they came with. This is not unique to the Boers and Maori, of course. Virtually every colonial war that you want to examine finds the same problem. We had an empire built on its military might and its organization, fighting against Boer commandos who loosely coalesced into a few families at a time, and that was it. The result was always going to be inevitable. One of the good things about New Zealand going to the Boer War, to me, could be classed in two ways. First of all, they brought back experiences of war which you cannot find on a playing field in Trentham Camp or Waiuru. The second major point was it gave them a sense of independence. This was the last war in which New Zealanders fought under the command of some other country. We learnt very quickly that unless you had independence of command, you could not have independence on the battlefield. And from this state forward, we demanded independence, sometimes in conflict with our major partners like the Americans or like the British in World War II. But we demanded that independence of operation to give us the facility to use our unique skills on the battlefield. And this is where it started. The New Zealand Mounted Rifle Units started off a tradition of excellence which we have tried to follow ever since in New Zealand. They were highly regarded and were regarded as superior to the French, to the Canadians and to the Australians. In fact, one senior officer said, British officer said, they made themselves very popular out here. They are spoken very well of by all and greatly preferred to the Australians. Remember that next time you're in Australia. the big issue for me is this last one. The The Boer War, for me as an ex-military officer, gave to me that form of self-confidence that can only come from excellence when you are comparing yourself to other organizations and military units. And the Boer War still reverberates through our culture and military training. Thank you. Any questions?
Well, thank you very much, Brian. Now, are there anyone who would like to ask Brian any questions?
Is it true that what was then known as Eteric, and is now known as Typhoid, was the biggest killer of people involved in the war?
Yes, definitely.
True that some
Maoris
actually did go to the
World
War?
Yes, there were. Whether it was a blind eye or whether it was not, they changed their names. I know of two East Coast Maoris from those particular tribes, lighter skinned and so on, who passed themselves off and performed very well.
My grandfather fought there, but he said, Lord Bay and Powell, the founder of the Boy Scout movement, they brought the Maoris to shoot blacks, the New Zealand troops.
Sorry,
I can't. New Zealand troops that had Maoris in there?
Yes.
Made the Maoris to shoot the blacks, Lord Bay and Powell.
I didn't know that.
The only other thing is, there's only one New Zealand and one Victoria Cross.
Yes.
Officers thought that they had it was up to the British to nominate our soldiers.
This was one of the lesser reasons why we said we're going to do it ourselves. We will command. Yep. Sorry.
How many New Zealanders joined up in Australia, England, or even in South Africa?
I don't know. I don't know. But interesting question. I shall find out. Google will tell me.
There were a number that paid their own way to South Africa,
yes,
because they weren't accepted in New Zealand, but they joined things like Bethune's Horse, a local unit over in South Africa.
And also agreed their loyalty in these wars was armed with British forces.
Sorry, I can't hear. I was
definitely
supposed to.
Yeah. Can you speak up, please?
Well, I have read towards the end, wars were mostly armed with British army rifles, and they had captured.
Towards the end of the war, they issued or used one of the British weapons.
You're quite right. They were issued with the Lee Enfield. But the weapon of choice, what happened was that the British finally realised that Lorenco Marks was the access point for German Mausers and rifled artillery and so on. And so they then took that railway, destroyed it, and so the Boers were landlocked. They then resorted to the use of British weapons, which were not, by the way, bad weapons.
When we were young fellas in the 60s, mates and I would buy the old 303s, and the mates and the Germans rifles were far superior than the 303 was.
Yes, I had the privilege recently of actually firing a Mauser. I wanted to bring it here today, but of course the gun laws have changed to such an extent I couldn't. Well, otherwise I'd be locked up in the central police station. It's a beautiful rifle. Beautifully balanced. They are still around. They're still used by hunters in New Zealand. Ammunition is becoming a bit of a problem, but they are still there.
I saw a poster many years ago advertising for soldiers to go to the Boer War, and it cost them so many pounds.
Yes.
If they had a horse, it didn't cost so much.
That's right. Yes.
One last question, any more? Well, yes?
I'm from Liverpool. We have a famous football club. And part of the football ground is actually called the Spion Cop.
Yes.
And I don't think anybody knows the reason why, but I can see today.
Yes.
That's
I remember Spion Cop in the football ground. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, for this talk today. I guess for many people who have read a little bit about the Boer War or anything like that, they didn't go back as far as what Brian did with the detail which brought us up step by step by step to bring us to the period when the tensions boiled over. And so there's a lot more in this talk today than what I expected, and I guess many of you other people were probably expecting to have more of the talk about New Zealanders fighting in the Boer War. But I think what you've said today has given a lot more background that people didn't know about or understand before. Just one small thing to note, that there were two New Zealanders that were killed after the peace was signed. And these people were killed, two New Zealanders were killed because the Boers didn't have the communications, and the Boers that killed these fellas didn't know that the peace had been declared. So there's little things like that, and that happens in just about every war. So I'd like you to all show your...
Thanks.
Thank you. Just one last...